Accession number 19990, Reel 6.
Chief Technician Roper, Reel 6.
No, the way it used to work, we would be engineering wing. Now, you might have people that were in the radio bay or the electrical bay in your room, but you were all under the same sort of wing, if you like, the engineering wing. But where shift workers were concerned, because they tended to appreciate the shift that were off, had to get their sleep and so on, you probably got separate accommodation for people that were working all night or so on, so that they weren't disturbed when they should have been sleeping.
Did you have a reveille in the morning or anything of that sort?
I believe there was a reveille, but it wasn't a... it was a taped reveille over the tannoy system. Although I can't with any honesty say that it was. I mean, we used to get tannoy messages, and I would have been surprised if they didn't sort of put some sort of bugle call over at 6:30 or whatever time. Yes.
Where did you do your feeding?
On these stations, they all tend to be the same design, and you've got a barrack square, and at one end of the barrack square is the NAFI building, and at the other end is the airman's mess. And it was usually a two-storey building, and depending on the size of the station, there could be sort of the equivalent to four mess halls run off two serveries, central serveries. But the food was quite good. And at Hemswell we had a pig farm or a farm. Yes, we had a station farm. And they usually reared pigs, but they also grew crops. And I can remember that a new station commander arriving, and the first thing he said on his inspection of the cookhouse was, "Do you have any pom?" And the flight sergeant in charge of the rations said, "Oh, yes, sir." He said, "Well, please remove it all and take it across and feed it to the pigs." And this endeared this new station commander to all and sundry on the station. And after that, the feeding prior to this had always been done very much like the army do it, where each man was entitled to two slices of bread, a piece of cheese, and so on. But then the RAF decided that they could buy, where they were in country areas, they could buy fresh vegetables at very reasonable prices. And so they sort of tended to buy what the people wanted to eat. And we started to get chips, which sort of were, through dietary considerations, were sort of not on the menu all that often. And I think between the medical officer and the catering officer, no longer did we get the tins of green gauge jam and presumably margarine and so on. We started to get the things that we could really eat. And the Air Force catering never looked back after that. They improved.
So they're adopting local purchase and also growing their own on the station?
A lot of the bigger stations had big farms, yeah.
And presumably also by this stage the rationing was easing off.
Oh, yes, yes.
We were discussing the changes in rationing, because by middle 50s I was presuming that rationing was beginning to ease a bit.
That's right. And of course you got in-flight catering and things like this that was you started to get sort of self-catering on certain units that worked on, like the fire section, and people like this started to cater for themselves. And so there was a general easing, and the food certainly improved.
Now, you mentioned that the station commander endeared himself by ordering the farm to be fed with pigs.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see much of the station commander?
You saw him approximately once a month, because he used to come round and inspect your sections or your barrack blocks. And depending on what your job was, quite often the CO would fly, and if you were involved with what was usually known as the station flight, where they kept an Oxford or an Anson or a Chipmunk, I'm not sure whether Chipmunks were in those days, but Oxfords and Ansons were usually the station flight aircraft, and the CO often used the Anson or the Oxford. And sometimes this duty was over and above. You did a week on station flight, or looking after the visiting aircraft, because you used to get people visit your station with aircraft that weren't common to you, and you'd have to get the books out from the aircraft and do the turnarounds and stuff on them. But the CO of Hemswell during my time, and I'm not sure whether he was the one that had the POM sent to the pigsties, was Honest John Searby. Now, John Searby was the youngest group captain in the Air Force. He had married the AOC's daughter, but he was also one of the Dambuster raid, and in fact he died last year. And I believe he brought a book out just before he died. But
so he died in 1996.
Mm-hmm. But he was a very high profile, because of his Dambuster connection. Everybody knew him. I mean, he played rugby against us. You know, the officers used to get a 15 up, and Honest John Searby was one of the opposing team, because you had to be careful with it being the station commander that
you didn't tackle him too hard.
Or swear too loud at him. Yeah.
I think your next move was in February 1956, when you went to 284 Squadron.
Yes, now, the thing was that Cyprus was sort of, the ochre problems had grown, and the Field Marshal Sir John Harding, as he was in those days, later Lord Harding, requested that he wanted helicopters, and he had a flight formed at RAF Nicosia of about three or four machines.
Yeah.
And these had operated on internal security duties for some months, and then it was decided that they would make it up to a full squadron. And this is when we were posted there to join this newly formed or reformed 284 squadron.
Right. I'll just...
And of course at this time there were a lot of people being drafted to Cyprus because of the problems, certainly a lot of army personnel. There was all over the island there were these army units sort of searching the hills for the terrorists, and not only that, of course, that the Suez crisis was looming as well. A lot of the people that had been on these stations in the zone were posted into Cyprus to finish their tours. Some squadrons, 114 Squadron with Valettas, came over from the canal zone. I think they'd been at Abaswere or Fayed, and they came to Nicosia to sort of continue their flying.
What? How much notice did you get that you were going off to Middle East Air Force?
Usually about 6 weeks, because you had to get somewhere in the region of a fortnight's disembarkation leave in. You had to go down to Innsworth and get your uniform issued to you and tailored if necessary. So I would think I had about 6 weeks' notice.
Did you have any inoculations or...?
Oh yes, you always got the relevant inoculations. which differed slightly Middle East wise. You know, it was normally tetanus and cholera, I think. The Far Eastern inoculation, you always got the yellow fever, but I think you had two or three jabs. And
did you have any inkling before you got your order that you were going to be posted or where you were going to be sent?
No, I was posted to either just Middle East Air Force, Cyprus. Mm-hmm. And I can remember we flew out from Stansted and arrived quite late at night at Nicosia. Or, sorry, it wasn't all that late, but it was dark. Yeah. And we were taken off the aircraft, and there was a reception committee there, an officer and two or three NCOs, who whose job it was to get us fed and get us bedded down for the night. And we ended up, I remember, in a tented camp. And
In the Nicosia area?
Oh, yes, it was on the edge of RAF Nicosia. It was it was a sort of, well, rapidly put up, more or less a transit camp, but it was full of RAF regiment, and we were billeted there. And I can remember going to bed that evening, and there was a very large bang, and the aircraft that we'd flown on, a Hermes, was blown up in the airport by saboteurs, which sort of was a bit off-putting. You know, we thought, this isn't very pleasant.
Had you been aware of what was going on Cyprus before you flew out there?
Oh, yes. The Daily Mirror, I seem to remember, was carrying some pictures of either an airman or a soldier shot in Ledra Street, and it was sort of very much like the IRA sort of reports of these days. But I remember that this rather shocking picture was in the Daily Mirror, and the gentleman who met us when we arrived came on the aircraft and said, now, don't believe all you've been reading in the papers. This is quite safe, and you can all write to your mothers and fathers and tell them that, you know, you're not likely to be murdered overnight. It's only in certain areas that you've got to be very careful. And sort of tended to try and put our minds at rest, but if you'd been reading the newspapers for the previous 6 or 8 weeks, it was constantly in the news.
Had you had any sort of security briefing on how to look after yourself in Cyprus before you flew out?
No. On any RAF unit, you annually have to go on the range and do sort of a week. It usually is. You go on the range, you do first aid, and you do weapons training, cleaning, and so on. But when you get out to a station that is fairly active, you're going to have to do guard duties. You may be manning a type of weapon, say an Oerlikon or something like this, that you've never even seen before. And so as part of an initial training, if you like, when you get to a unit, you have to do a lot of the basic stuff before they let you go to do the job you're there for, to go to the squadron and work. So
you're sort of holding and training phase before you go to work.
Yeah.
Right? What did that take when you got to Nicosia?
Well, it would probably be done within the first 2 or 3 days. You had to... there were certain things you had to do. Because when you arrive on a unit, you're given a card which needs 2 dozen signatures on it. And so you go around the station, and this familiarises you with the layout. And it's rather a big station, and the technical area is miles from the domestic area, and the headquarters area is in a different place. And so you wander around for a day or 2 days, finding all the medical section to make sure your documents have arrived and you're registered, the dentist, the equipment section, And you might have to have certain equipment that's issued probably a tin helmet or something, so you've got to go to the stores and you're issued with sort of specialist clothing or whatever that you need. In my case, I was going to be crewing, so I had flying clothing issued. But firefighters would have special suits issued and so on. And then you had to do this... you were going to be doing guards, and so you went down and were briefed about the security situation and took it from there.
Do you remember what they said in your briefing about the security situation?
They sort of... you were going to be sent on guard, and there were certain... It was mainly aircraft dispersals. Yeah. There were wire perimeter fences and lights, and there was probably only one entrance, or a checkpoint where nobody but nobody must be allowed in without them being checked over and so on. And you were always in pairs, and one would be covering the sentry that was actually at the post. You were given instructions in how to challenge anybody you saw. Halt stamata dur was the one, which is in Greek and Turkish, I believe it means halt. And then they would all have identity cards. There was Turkish guards and Greeks who had passes and so on. But usually in the areas where the aircraft were, there were no personnel other than the Turkish auxiliary guards anywhere near them. And we all had loaded rifles. You went on, it was two on and four off usually. And you went on guard at 4 o'clock in the evening. You would then, the guard commander would usually have two old hands that had done it before, and he'd send them out on the first stint. And during the first stint, the evening meal would arrive. This came round in a sort of van arrangement with a cook driving, and he had hot meals in these circular tubular things. And then an urn of tea, which was the most important thing. And whilst you were sort of having your cup of tea and the meal, you were briefed, particularly if you'd never done the guard before, there was quite a screed read out to you. And really, they used to convince young airmen that hadn't ever done the guard before that you had to be prepared to shoot, and you shot to make sure you stopped the person. And, of course, during your tour of guard, you were likely to be approached by the Rockoak personnel. The RAF regiment would attempt to get into your position, which was dangerous in itself. Or they'd try and get you to leave your post and so on. So most of the guards were really on the ball, and they were out to catch anybody that was sort of testing their security.
So it's a static guard post you're manning for 2 hours on? And then
well, you patrolled. You might have a load, a row of, yes, say, eight aircraft.
Right.
And there'd be one of you at each end, and you'd sort of go round and meet in the middle and then go back. Or it might be a gate.
Yes.
And an area where it's well illuminated that you had to keep an eye on. There were some... Well, it was mainly regiment personnel that guarded the CNC's house, which was away from the camp and quite vulnerable.
What sort of wire fence was there? You mentioned that it was fenced. Was it
they were about 8 or 9 feet high, angled iron with barbed wire along the angle at the top edge, very similar to sort of fences you see now.
Yes.
I mean, fences did differ. You could have three coils of barbed wire sort of to prevent people entering.
Yes.
Because these areas, aircraft had to, they were peritracks and the like, and aircraft had to taxi in and out.
Yeah.
A lot of it was just razor wire.
How often would these guard duties come round?
About every 20 days. And as I say, they were quite grueling. You know, you knew you'd done it after you'd been on.
Was there any incident when you were on guard that you observed?
We had one man that was shooting at a Bowser that was full of avgas because he hadn't stopped at his checkpoint and he was actually firing live rounds into the thing. We had another chap that shot a donkey.
How did that happen?
It was in the trees and he called for it to halt and it didn't halt, so he opened fire and it was the first time I've ever seen a dead donkey.
Presumably he was just shooting at the movement.
Yeah.
Because he wouldn't have been able to tell, would he?
No, he knew there was something there, and he picked the right spot.
And it didn't.
And it turned out, and it turned out to be a donkey. But there were some nasty instances where things blew up that you were sort of adjacent to. In the stores compound, there was a bomb in an engine case. They'd already taken out this aircraft at the Civvy Airport. And of course there was a lot of accidental discharges of weapons.
How were they treated?
Well, there was always an inquiry, but it was strange. A chap jumping out of a one-ton truck and the butt of his Sten hit the back tailgate and he fired a burst onto the floor, which went up, ricocheted up, and hit 10 rounds in one of his friend's pockets, his breast pocket. And, you also had the terrorists putting bombs in. There was a fountain, and a team, either a cricket team or a hockey team or something, went to the fountain and it blew up.
Were you personally involved in any incident while you were on guard?
The problems we had, we used to fly off with the aircraft.
Yes.
And you were going to areas where either the army were actively engaged.
Yes, I was thinking about when you were on guard duty. Were you ever involved personally in an incident of any sort when you were on guard on the
not where we had to fire.
No.
And of course, in my position, I was probably the guard commander.
Yes.
Who was responsible for, rather than doing the patrols, for sending the patrols out and checking on them, and making sure that they changed on time and so on. So.
You'd be in the guard post
then. I'd be in the guard post most of the time, other than when we were changing the guards.
How many men would you have under your command on guard overnight?
Something like a dozen. I believe I'm right in saying when you went paraded to do your guard, there was something like, 150, 250 men.
Yes.
And there were trucks waiting to take them to the locations they were going to operate from. But my guard posts were usually on dispersals, and I'd have probably 12 men in a tent, and there'd be, say, 10 beds or 8 beds. And
how many would you actually have doing the active guarding then? Because if you were 2 on, 4 off, it means you've got about one-third of your chaps on.
Yeah, we'd have 4 out on guard and 8 in.
Yes.
And you could, some guard commanders would allow you to double up.
Yes.
And do, instead of, you were supposed to do 2 on, 4 off or something, but you could do 4 on and was four. It yeah, and 4 off. I know they used to arrange it amongst themselves, but you had to come to a consensus if they were prepared to do it that way. Because there were some of the guard stints which were bad, the early morning one. It gets very cold, and also there's a lot of mist about. You get advection fog. And this mist is usually only sort of from your chest downwards. But it's an eerie sort of thing to be sort of dealing with, you know. It really has you on your toe, and it's a very lonely stint of guard, is that particular first light.
It's often said that one of the problems with guards is that if you do lead them on for more than a couple of hours, they start seeing things because they get so bored staring into the night.
Well, we had in a case where we had a guard that got sort of bored, and he was playing about, and he fired a round from a rifle that was on his shoulder, and when he looked up, it had gone straight through the nose of the aircraft he was standing under. And that sort of caused a bit of a problem. But I think everybody took the guard seriously. You never found anybody sleeping.
Were you allowed any extra rest after you'd been on guard? Because it is a rather rigorous thing to do.
No, I think you came off the guard. I seem to think that the Turkish auxiliaries did the guarding during normal daylight hours, and I know the guards went on duty at 4 o'clock in the evening, and I believe that you finished at probably 8 o'clock the following morning, but I can't be sure about that. But you would probably get the rest of the day off as a stand down.
Yes. So then you could catch up on your sleep.
Yeah.
And relax a bit.
Mm.
Did you find it very alarming when your aircraft was blown up on that first night?
Having been met and the flight lieutenant came on board the aircraft, he was the movements officer for that day, and assuring us that there was nothing to worry about, we went back to these tents, and I don't think we had any light. So we made our beds, and at that time they were ordinary camp beds. And there was seemed nothing else to do, so we retired early. And then all of a sudden, all hell let loose. There was a big bang and a ball of flame, and the powers that be were getting the regiment chaps out to go and sort of see what was going on in case it wasn't contained. And to be told it was the aircraft, the Hermes, had been blown up. Because, of course, it would have been refuelled, ready for going back to the UK the following day, presumably taking time-expired personnel home, you know.
But this was on the civil airport, not in the military.
Well, of course, Nicosia, we commandeered the civilian airport. And there was because there were civilian passengers using the airport, there was a small enclosed area where the civilian aircraft taxied in, and Greek and Turkish and so on got off their aircraft and were bussed out to Nicosia town. And I believe that the Hermes, because we had to come through customs controls, was actually in this little civvy bit that we'd left them. Further round the airfield, there was the what we call Cyprus Airways hangar, which we had commandeered, but that was all part of the civilian airport at one time, but we took it on because of the situation.
Now, you said you'd seen reports of this man who'd been killed in Ledra Street in Nicosia. Were you allowed out off the camp into the town at all?
We were allowed, because on the outskirts of Nicosia was a vast estate where the married families lived and had done for the years that they'd been in Cyprus. You could also go into town, but there were certain areas that were out of bounds. The walled city, because it is a walled city, you weren't allowed inside the walls. Ledra Street, I think, was out of bounds, but there were certain areas, the Turkish quarter, parts of the Turkish quarter were out of bounds, but not for security reasons, because they were sort of brothels and things. But you could go, and you had to go out armed if there were four of you, two of you had to be armed, and depending on your rank, depending on whether you had to be in uniform with a rifle or a Sterling, or a Sten gun rather, the officers could go out in civvies because they had pistols. And certain senior NCOs that had pistol chips could get pistols if there were any available to them, and they could wear civilian clothing. And of course, the people that were married living in Nicosia itself walked around in civilian clothing with their